argument this morning is Bauer against the United States.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Smith on behalf of the Bowers and also arguing on behalf of the Spurgeon estate as well. Mr. Sheridan, who was listed, I believe, is hospitalized. Mr. Prindable, however, is here for that firm. On March 20th, 1998, my clients, John Bauer, 47, and his son William, 20, were returning from Louisville, heading back to the Aurora area, and as was Terry Spurgeon, 42 years old, also a passenger. All three were passengers in the Beach Bonanza, a six-passenger aircraft. The pilot was Dan Sanders, an IFR pilot. And as they crossed,
I think we know all that, but you've got a case here where you have a whole bunch of experts that say it was all the FAA's fault and the air traffic controller's fault. They have experts that say it was pilot error. The judge makes a credibility determination and assesses the evidence and says both were at fault, but pilot error was the proximate cause. How do you win this case, ICF?
I believe we win it quite handily, Your Honor, based upon clearly erroneous decisions made by the court with regard to his findings of fact, and I'll get right to that then. The court found that errors committed by the FAA, as you point out, the personnel specifically of the FSS, Gilpin was his name, was not his errors were not a proximate cause of the crash based upon essentially two elements.
Would you say there's no pilot error?
I believe the evidence is quite strong that there was not pilot error, but nonetheless, even if this court were to disagree with me on that point, the fact is that we established a proximate cause with regard to the flight service personnel as well, in our opinion. So, as passengers and innocent parties, their obligation would not be to establish that the pilot committed no error at all, but simply that the flight service station personnel contributed to proximately cause the occurrence in this case. And I believe we can show how that was done. That they need to establish a proximate cause, a cause which in natural or probable sequence contributed to the crash in this instance. The court essentially said that there were errors by flight service station, as I was indicating, based upon two essential elements, one of which was that the pilot received the AirMet Zulu, and two local Louisville area PIREPs, pilot reports in the Louisville area from Gilpin. Secondly, a purported fact that we say is not in the evidence whatsoever, that the pilot knew of freezing rain in central Indiana. And if it's acceptable to the court, I did want to put up the AirMet that was exhibit 32A in large, 32 in your material, the 32A, which shows how the AirMet is laid out. And the AirMet that he received talked about a surface to 16,000 on a Bradford, Illinois to Cincinnati line, and the surface to 16 was above that line. The blue line represents the ultimate route of flight that the pilot took from Louisville to Springfield with the intention and then up toward Aurora. That was 3,000 to 16,000. The court held that the AirMet, despite all of the testimony in the case, that the AirMet told the pilot that there would be icing in the area in which he ultimately filed his flight plan. That was clearly erroneous because every single piece of evidence in the case described this at best as forecast. Forecast. Our Borschelt, the evidence.
What does that mean?
Pardon me?
What does that mean?
It means that it may or may not occur. It is not known. And
everything kind of may or may not occur.
Yes.
Right? Isn't all weather forecasting probabilistic?
I would say that is true with regard to forecasts, yes.
So now I'm puzzled by the point you're making.
The point I'm making is that the court has determined and said, as finding a fact, that there would be icing in this area where he's flying. Not that there might be, not that there's some probability, either less or more than 50%, but there indeed would be icing. It's important because the violation that the government pursued as against this pilot was one in which they are saying he flew into known icing. Every single expert in the case, including Mr. Coogan, including Mr. Baldwin, their experts, acknowledged that indeed this is forecast, it is not known. And the only way you can convert something which is forecast to known is by pilot reports of actual occurrences.
Isn't the most important decision you make in flying one of these small airplanes the decision whether you're going to even go or not? And what did they know when they left?
When they left, he had been given, by virtue of the briefing he'd gotten from, he knew of this AirMet, which, as I was commenting, covers multiple states. It continues up in Ontario, and it's considered rather vague in general. And he had two pilot reports in the Louisville area. So any suggestion that he flew into known, he's actually flying away from anything he was described as of their having been known, those pilot reports at Louisville. He's flying away from but not into. He knew those two things. He was also given a Lafayette pilot report. And he also told the briefer that he had he was asked the question, do you have the weather up in the Chicago area? And he acknowledged, yes, I have that up in Chicago. And I can address that specifically. The government has, in their brief, gone further than the court did, actually. The court never found that indicated in any way that the pilot had any central Indiana weather, which we raised. We contend that the flight service briefer was obligated to provide the central Indiana in-route forecasting. Specifically required in number 5
I don't, speaking at least for me, that's not intelligible.
Very well.
If there's some place in the materials you've
it
given
is.
Us.
It's in the 7110.
Where?
10.
Where? Is that in the appendix?
It is.
Okay.
It's in the record, I should say.
Oh, well.
It is the 7110, which requires, within the standard briefing, the giving of in-route forecasts along the route of flight, both leaving Louisville, crossing Indiana, and on up to Chicago. And there is no question that was never provided. We believe the finding that the AirMet, the court held, that it would be icing in the route of flight is clearly erroneous because it represents a major facet in the express way that the court here denied any proximate cause relationship with regard to the errors that it acknowledged the flight service station personnel committed and the ultimate crash that he was told that there would be along the way. When indeed that wasn't the case, it was simply possible icing through that area at 3,000 to 16,000. Secondly, the court also, I think, was clearly erroneous in identifying that the pilot had in his aircraft a plaque or placard that said that flight in known icing conditions is prohibited. That fact, it was established, was not in that aircraft. We did that in cross-examination of Mr. Coogan. We showed him the manual that described what the placard did indeed have, and that placard did not have such language for that aircraft, the manual from that aircraft. But the court found that indeed that placard was there, and that's important because The court is utilizing that to support the proposition that the pilot, even in the face of a warning in his aircraft, has taken off across Indiana with information about icing conditions. That's flatly contradicted by the manual itself of this aircraft. Thirdly, the court, in its conclusions of law, found the pilot violated 14 CFR 91.9 when he flew into known icing conditions, which the court then said the manual had a prohibition against. And that's not so. The manual had a prohibition against flying in known icing conditions, and we contend that the words here are quite important. Pilots can inadvertently fly into a situation in which icing occurs. The prohibition is about being in the icing conditions and continuing to fly in those conditions and not leaving it. The prohibition for this aircraft was flying in known icing conditions, and the court, we contend, was clearly erroneous in its finding of law, but indeed I believe de novo would actually be the standard on that finding of with regard to the law here on that point. The manual did not have such a prohibition, and indeed there was no evidence in the case that demonstrated that the pilot flew into known icing conditions. Known, everyone agreeing, would be reported elements of ice that other aircraft had encountered it, and there were none given to the pilot crossing Indiana in the area that he was going. So there is no evidence of known icing conditions that he's flying into. Significantly, this pilot direct affirmative efforts based upon his concerns. He spoke with the flight service station person, Gilpin, specifically asking about icing, went virtually ignored here, when in reality they should have played a significant role in assessing proximate cause. He called with concerns of icing to that flight service station person. Secondly, he asked the Evansville air traffic controller, once he was out over Indiana, the very first words out of his mouth is, "Do you have any reports of icing?" And he was told, "No, not in the last 2 hours." Indeed, there had been two, as we point out. And now that impact there is significant. One, he's trying to either confirm or not what's going on with the forecast, and he's not given the information. So he's thus inclined to assess this, oh, it's forecast, it's not happening. They didn't give him those two. Secondly, he continues on, despite, I believe it's referenced in our materials, there's an aircraft, 371 Juliet Delta, that's come down from Michigan, down to Evansville, and reports icing from down south of Terre Haute, down towards Evansville, right across the path of the direction Alpha, our aircraft was going. This is exhibit, it was called 152 during the examination of expert Farrell Jones, but truly 27A, and it was an error by Mr. Durkin, as I recall. But the path of that aircraft coming down from Michigan is directly where our aircraft was going, and they didn't give him that report of actual icing having occurred on an aircraft coming down from 8,000 feet, accumulating into 4,500. Our aircraft was at 4,000, and that was found to have been irrelevant by the court below. Third effort by this pilot upon being handed off from Evansville to Terre Haute, immediate inquiry again about pilot reports, and ATC personnel Staley said none in the last several hours. Now that means that the Evansville people didn't give her the report of 371 Juliet Delta that's coming down here, relate that back into the system so she could tell them about that. Three times this pilot makes requests for information, and three times he is denied that. Denied it in terms of not receiving it at Louisville for the forecast required by the standard briefing, denied it when asking for pilot reports, and denied it when asking Ms. Staley for those as well. Now, the question of whether this could proximately cause the pilot to do something, I think, is helped significantly by what the court actually did here. The court concluded that indeed the pilot must have received the area forecast for central Indiana, despite the fact there's nothing in the transcript to suggest that at all. He concluded that based upon his view that the pilot had changed his route of flight, although both parties agree there was never an initial route of flight identified. He just said, I'm going to Aurora from Louisville. The court determined that he changed
his
route.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Would you take those things down, please?
I will. May it please the court. Justin Cretien on behalf of the United States. After listening to Mr. Smith and reviewing a 55-page brief with more than a dozen allegations of error, I'm reminded of the line from Macbeth, Act 2, that says, confusion hath now made its masterpiece. But this is, in fact, a simple case. On the evening of March 20th, 1998, pilot Sanders wanted to fly from Louisville, Kentucky to Aurora, Illinois, taking three passengers with him. His aircraft was a single-engine Beech Bonanza, and it had no de-icing equipment on board, and he knew that. And in fact, he also is charged with the knowledge contained within his flight manual that says that flight in known icing conditions is prohibited. I have a copy of the actual trial exhibit. It's defense trial exhibit number 20, and it reads, warning, flight in known icing conditions is prohibited. Pilot Sanders got a weather brief, as he's required to do prior to takeoff. The weather brief included a warning, an advisory to airmen. It's called an air met, that icing conditions were forecast along the entire route of flight. That's an air met. It is a forecast. The weather briefer, however, also included in the brief three pilot reports. These are reports that pilots radio down who are flying in the soup, if you will. These three pilot reports, two of them were from the Louisville area. One reported icing conditions from 4,000 feet that didn't lose until 3,000 feet. Another reported moderate to severe icing at 6,000 feet. Now, that's the immediate area around the point of departure. And there was a third one at Lafayette reporting icing at a higher altitude, I think 7,500 to 8,000 feet, and that's about two-thirds of the way, but it's on the route from Louisville to Aurora. These three pilot reports, as you'll see, the way the NTSB has dealt with this, either forecast or reported icing constitutes known icing. In this case, we have both forecast and reported icing conditions. Other information included in this weather briefing included the surface observations at the point of departure and at Terre Haute and at the destination, which was Aurora. Those surface observations, it's a report of what's happening at that particular airport at that time. It's not a forecast. An observation of the ceiling and the visibility and any precipitation. Reported light snow at Terre Haute and low ceilings at Terre Haute and low visibilities. Low ceilings also at Louisville, the point of departure. It was better in the Aurora area, but en route, at the point of departure and en route, the weather was poor. In fact, instrument conditions prevailed over much of the route.
When a pilot encounters icing, What's the pilot to do?
Your Honor, in an aircraft not equipped for icing, the best thing for a pilot to do
is to be fully apprised, as per the Federal Aviation Regulation, of what he can reasonably expect to encounter. That means getting a detailed weather brief about air met and about the instrument conditions along the route of flight. What he's concerned with is the existence of moisture, clouds, if you will, coupled with freezing temperatures. Those are the conditions necessary for the formation of ice on the aircraft. It's not ice floating in the air. These are super-cooled rain droplets that are near or even sometimes below the freezing point, but when the aircraft goes through that air mass, under those two conditions, icing will form on the aircraft surfaces. And if you do not have de-icing equipment to shake off or melt off that ice, then the aircraft is going to suffer a decrease in lift, a decrease in thrust, and an increase in drag and weight. And that's, in fact, what happened in this case.
Well, is there something the pilot can do, then, to avoid a catastrophic?
Besides bail out, I mean.
Yes, sir. And many aircraft are modified with what are called de-icing boots. And what these are pneumatic rubber sleeves that fit over the leading edge of the wings and the horizontal stabilator. And those,
when installed on ATR 42s, may or may not work.
Yes, sir. And there are problems with them, and the pilot has to be very savvy in how he operates, and there are different techniques.
Right, one would think your answer is land, right? If you're in a plane with no de-icing equipment and you end up in icing conditions, you land.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in this particular case...
So the question is, why didn't you give that answer? Is there some significance to that?
Your Honor, that's the most obvious answer. First, you try to avoid it. Second, if you get into it and you don't have de-icing equipment, you get out of it. If you've got de-icing equipment, then you can... I thought that was what your question was going to. But yes, you're right, Your Honor. The first thing to do is to avoid it. The second, if you get into it, is to get out of it. And what that means, in this particular case, he's departing from Louisville, and when he departs from Louisville, the only sure route that is free of ice is the one he just left. He doesn't know what's ahead of him, obviously, or ignored it. The only sure safe bet was for him to turn around and return to his point of departure. Everything else is a gamble, and in this case, he lost. Your Honor, after receiving this weather information, the pilot elected to take off and soon encountered the very icing conditions that were forecast and reported. He didn't turn around. He didn't descend immediately. Instead, he continued northward. He overflew airports that he could have landed at, and ultimately asked for vectors to Terre Haute because of the ice.
Is there a lawsuit against the pilot?
Not to my knowledge.
Has the estate?
No, sir. Not by the United States.
No, not by the United States.
By the States.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The three people died in this crash. They sued the pilot.
I think you'd have to ask Mr. Smith about any litigation involving the estate. I don't know. I don't recall. I think I knew it 2 years ago, but I don't recall as I sit here. Well,
do you think that would be something that would be discussed by the pilots and the passenger before departing? That'd be a little risky here.
Yes,
and in fact, or shouldn't we? And who makes the final decision?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, one of the passengers was another pilot, but we didn't seek to attribute negligence to the other passenger in this case. At Terre Haute, the controller complies with his request and immediately gives him vectors and a clearance to Terre Haute. Subsequent to that, the pilot comes on the radio and says, "We can't seem to shed this ice. We need something closer." At that point, the controller gave vectors immediately to Sullivan Airport, which was just 5 or 6 miles on his nose. Now, Sullivan's airport is oriented north and south. They were coming from the south. It was conveniently aligned for a straight-in approach. It was at 2,500 feet. It would have been a 4-degree glide path, and that's not disputed. What happened instead was that the pilot said, "I want the VOR alpha approach." By its designation, the alpha, the suffix, designates it as a circling approach. The controller said, "Fine," and commenced to vector him a series of three turns, one to the southwest, a second turn to the northwest, and then would require a third turn to the northeast to intercept the final approach course back towards Sullivan. The evidence showed clearly at trial that once this pilot, whose aircraft was slowing down because of the ice, once he made that first turn to the southwest, he lacked the altitude and the airspeed, or the energy in the pilot vernacular, to make it to any airport. He would not have made it to Sullivan, no matter what he did, and he would not have made it to any alternative airports like Robinson Airport, which was even further away than Sullivan. And so anything that happened after that point, inaccuracy in a vector given by Ms. Staley of 10 or 20 degrees, which she later corrected, is not germane to proximate cause. Once he made that decision, he was just picking where the aircraft was going to crash. At trial, the appellants claimed that the briefer provided an inadequate weather brief, and they focused mostly on the area forecast and the MIS. Briefly, the area forecast was not given to the pilot. That is true. The reason why is because the pilot already had it. The briefer said, you already have the forecast in the Chicago area, and the controller and the pilot said, you already got the forecast up there in the Chicago area? The pilot said, I do. So the briefer, that's on page 3 of Defense Exhibit 19, Trial Exhibit 19. That's the full transcript. So there's no need for the briefer to give him what he already had. As far as the meteorological impact statement, the MIS, which they have spent an inordinate amount of time talking about, it is not something that's ever given to a flight service station briefer. It is a document produced for staff-level supervisors at centers and was never, and there's no evidence in the record that it ever made it or ever makes it to a remote facility like the Louisville Flight Service Station. It has absolutely nothing to do with what went on that day, and that's pretty well covered in the brief. I want to touch on three main areas very quickly. One is the allegations of the credibility of our experts. I just remind the court of its decision in Archambault in 1995, where this court held that the court may not reverse the district court's decision to credit the testimony of a witness who has told a coherent and facially plausible story that is not contradicted by extrinsic evidence. Here, the extrinsic evidence is the transcript, as well as the flight manual prohibition. Both of these pieces of extrinsic evidence corroborate and confirm the experts of the United States, and they don't contradict it whatsoever. Under these circumstances, certainly the deference must be given to the determinations of the trial court. With respect to the issue about known icing, I want to make it clear that I committed a typographical error in my brief when I wrote flight into instead of flight in. I interposed those two words. I regret the error. However, there are some cases that involve prohibitions and placards regarding flight into and flight in, and to me the words are interchangeable, but even so, what is at issue is what the district court considered. The district court considered this, which is the direct evidence itself, a copy of the prohibition that says flight in known icing conditions. So the argument, the extensive argument they put in their brief that this is some part of a conspiracy on my part to mislead the court has nothing to do with what the trial court did. The trial court considered the evidence properly and came up with the determination that this was flight in known icing conditions. In making that determination, the trial court's order relies upon the NTSB opinion, or the NTSB order, in Bossier, Administrative v. Bossier. This is one of their contentions that this was inappropriate somehow, but under the Supreme Court's ruling of Chevron, this court must give deference to an agency's determination that is within its ambit. The NTSB decided in Bossier, it considered the issue of what constitutes known icing conditions, and it expressly states in a case that involved a a pilot who had, on a very similar fact, penetrated icing conditions. It says icing conditions, non-icing conditions exist when they're either forecast, for planning purposes, when they're either forecast or reported. Now, the district court relied upon that, and there are other cases. For example, the Seventh Circuit in Bowman, or Bowen, I'm sorry, also discussed an NTSB opinion, and essentially it said about the same thing that the court did, that the NTSB did in Bossier, that the pilot was in possession of weather information that put him on notice that he could expect to encounter icing conditions on his intended flight path. And in light of this knowledge, the pilot violated FAR 91.9 by operating his aircraft in a careless or reckless manner, and 91.3 by violating the operation limits of his aircraft. That's the Bowen case from this circuit. It's right on point. This constituted known icing conditions. Finally, Your Honor, just to Your Honors, regarding the other elements of weather information that they contend should have been given, it reminds me of an analogy that's not perfect, but if you'll bear with me, of a person who runs a red light and has a collision in the intersection and then comes
Thank
back.
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement. Our next case is